Good morning, everybody. It's great to have a great turnout this morning. We got two important bills on our agenda today, members. We do have a quorum here at the Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. Vice Chair Mecklen, if you had a chance to go through the minutes from yesterday's meeting, and if so, we'd need a motion to move forward.
I have, Mr. Chair, and I so move the minutes.
Further discussions, members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are adopted from yesterday. As I mentioned, we have two bills today. We have House File 47 first up, Representative Schultz, and then we'll have Representative Johnson bill, House File 335, as soon as we're finished here, too. So, Representative Schultz, welcome to your own committee. And I think Representative Schultz moves House File 47 to be moved on to the Agriculture Committee, if I'm not mistaken. So, Representative Schultz, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad to be before you. Good morning, Lead Pinto, members of the committee, and thank you to all of the Minnesotans who have joined us this morning to talk about House File 47, which is a bipartisan bill in both bodies of the legislature, which will help provide critically needed fixes to the Underground Telecommunications Installer Certification Program. And this is following legislation that was passed in 2024. As we know, Minnesota is incredibly well positioned when it comes to broadband, and we are closer than ever to closing the digital divide and connecting Minnesotans and connecting Minnesota's remaining unserved and underserved communities. We're also set to receive $652 million in BEAD funding from the federal government. And with these dollars, we can fund critical infrastructure projects from Mankato to Minneapolis, from Malacca to Moorhead. Broadband not only connects us, but it is an essential tool for our businesses and local economy. Broadband creates numerous good-paying jobs, many of which are union jobs, and has tremendous spin-off benefits for our schools, healthcare, small businesses, hospitality, and more. Whether it's a student taking an online course, a small business selling their product across the globe, or a senior connecting to a virtual healthcare visit, we cannot do it without fast, reliable, and affordable broadband. But the certification program passed last session and currently set to take effect on July 1st of this year could bring critical broadband projects to a halt, especially in the metro area, as it is nearly impossible to get the fully certified program up and running and get all of the necessary workers through the training ahead of this date. Frankly put, our state policy has potentially boxed us into a corner which could delay broadband deployment, especially in our metro communities. While the law's intent is good, it does not take into account the experience of those already in the field doing this work or the time it takes for contractors and trade unions to create these new training programs, let alone receive the formal blessing and certification through the Department of Labor and Industry. If we don't tackle some of these changes this session, the impact will be felt across Minnesota. Our state simply won't have enough certified workers to do broadband projects, and many contractors and service providers, citing the complicated new hurdles for broadband, will simply choose other projects with fewer bureaucratic barriers. This would only delay service longer for Minnesotans who would lose the economic benefits of this investment. But members of the committee, and for everyone in the room right now, I want us all to choose to be optimistic and to envision the immense positive impact that will come when together we, in this room, get these safety, broadband, and economic development policies right. Together, we can have $652 million of broadband infrastructure investment that gets to benefit thousands of Minnesota workers. We get to have hundreds of Minnesota small businesses and contractors have work for nearly 5 years. Every Minnesotan can have access to affordable, quality, fast, and reliable internet. And trade unions can lead by example on safety standards and best practices. Utility providers and local municipalities can save precious time and money with fewer damaged lines and uncompensated fixes. And most of all, our communities can benefit with the tremendous financial impact when our dollars stay local with local regional contractors and companies who hire local workers. And those workers who live in our own communities, they work and raise a family and send their kids to our schools. They dine at our restaurants. They cheer on our sports teams. And together, we serve and lead and grow together. This is what it can look like when we are building for the future together. Members, broadband is a bipartisan issue that benefits us all, and I ask for your support of this bill today. I now want to turn it over to Melissa Wolf, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association, who can share more. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz, and welcome to the committee, Ms. Wolf. I want to remind you and other testifiers today that in this room, you kind of have to lean into the microphone or pull it towards you. It's a little bit hard of hearing, so just go ahead and reach into that. If you would, and Ms. Wolf, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and good morning. My name is Melissa Wolf, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association, or Minnesota Cable. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 47 today, and I want to especially thank Representative Schultz for bringing this important bill forward and the bipartisan group of House and Senate lawmakers who have signed on to this bill. Additionally, I want to thank the broadband contractors who are in the room today that have traveled from across the state to support this bill. And lastly, I want to acknowledge that as an industry, we have had productive meetings with and will continue to meet with stakeholders on this bill this session. Minnesota Cable represents cable companies who are proud to serve residents of Minnesota in every corner of the state, from Schaumburg's in Thief River Falls to SCI in Hinckley to Mediacom in Waseca. Collectively, Minnesota Cable members provide high-speed, reliable broadband connections to over 1.5 million residents in the metro, suburbs, and rural Minnesota. Everyone in this room understands that reliable, high-speed internet has become an essential service in modern society, and Minnesota is on the verge of achieving universal broadband access. But last year's telecommunications installer law threatens to derail our progress. If not modified to provide flexibility this legislative session, by July 1st of this year, this law will disqualify thousands of experienced broadband installers working anywhere in the 7-county metro area from working on broadband projects until they take 40 hours of state-mandated training and pass an exam. And it will take thousands of experienced broadband workers off the job of deploying broadband in greater Minnesota to take the 40 hours of training and pass an exam. The timing could not be worse because Minnesota has 4 construction seasons to deploy $652 million of broadband equity access and deployment, or BEAD, funding. We simply cannot afford to stop Minnesota's broadband train. If we don't get the BEAD job done on time, unserved communities will be stuck waiting years longer for high-speed internet access, and thousands of Minnesotans will be left in the digital dark, further disconnected from work, school, and healthcare. This bill, House File 47, has strong bipartisan support because it makes common sense fixes to what is currently an unworkable law. We know this law was well intended, but because the telecommunications installer law was passed last year without addressing any industry concerns, it has created unnecessary confusion and an impossible timeline. To be clear, this bill does not call for the repeal of last year's law. However, the following changes to the law are necessary to provide flexibility and ensure the uninterrupted deployment of broadband access across the state. There are 3 key issues that must be fixed. The first is the training timeline is simply impossible. This training program is the first of its kind in the U.S. Broadband providers are working in good faith and taking immediate action to develop a compliant program, but the reality is that without a deadline extension, there will not be enough certified trainers to meet demand, and the state will not have enough compliant workers before the July 1st, 2025 deadline, halting broadband projects in the middle of a construction season. For reference, within my membership alone, we anticipate 1,000 to 1,500 workers will need this certification by July 1st. The new law also requires a portion of this training to be hands-on. Underground excavation cannot take place until the ground thaws. You have all lived in Minnesota here for a while. You know that that might be March, that might be April, and that might be May in some parts of the state. That leaves us with as little as 2 months to meet a statewide mandate. When this deadline is missed, and under current conditions it will be, providers and contractors will have three impossible choices: shut down projects in the middle of a peak construction season, continue working out of compliance, putting projects and workers at legal risk, or lose permits, delaying broadband access indefinitely for thousands of Minnesotans. None of these are acceptable outcomes for you, for us, or for the people we serve. The second issue is the training requirements are confusing and contradictory. The Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry has been inconsistent with its guidance on who needs this training. Initially, we were told only individuals locating existing utilities using hand or hydro excavation methods and individuals locating the drill head of a directional drill rig were required to have this certification. But in a recent webinar, DLI stated that anyone working within 10 feet of existing utilities must be certified. This inconsistency is a direct result of the lack of clarity in the law and could create a scenario where every broadband worker in the state on any job site would need this certification. The law also requires at least two certified workers be present at all times at any location where broadband is being installed using directional boring. This is a staffing mandate that effectively doubles the required workforce on every job site at a time when qualified workers are already in short supply. Worse, the law doesn't actually define what a job site is. In Greater Minnesota, a broadband project can stretch for miles with multiple drill rigs working at once. How many certified workers are required in that case? Nobody has answered that question consistently, not DLI or the proponents of the law. Third, the 40-hour training requirement is excessive and arbitrary. The law mandates that every broadband worker complete 40 hours of training and pass a state-mandated test. For context, pipe layers who work on underground water and sewer pipes at far greater depths under the ground only need 4 hours of training. The 40-hour requirement will put thousands of experienced broadband installers off the job for a full week to meet a training requirement not found anywhere else in the country. Remember, contractors have choices. They can work on different infrastructure projects like water, gas, or electric without risking regulatory noncompliance. Faced with a choice between keeping their workforce in the field or losing an entire week to unnecessary training, a rational choice will be for contractors to stop taking broadband projects. Finally, I want to let you know that we've heard your direction to work with other stakeholders on this bill. And based on our stakeholder discussions, we have committed to working with other energy utilities to address some of their concerns that are found on page 2, lines 1 and 2. And for this reason, I won't address it in my testimony today. This bill only makes reasonable adjustments so broadband work is not interrupted and we meet the federal mandate to invest $652 million in Minnesota over the next 4 years. Minnesota can't afford to sideline its broadband workers. We cannot afford to play games with broadband deployment. Minnesota has made great strides in broadband expansion, but now we are at a crossroads. We can either fix a flawed law and keep Minnesota's broadband workforce in the field, doing the work of connecting Minnesotans to broadband, or let unnecessary bureaucracy sideline those workers and leave thousands of Minnesotans in the digital dark. Thank you for your time today and your consideration of this bill. I would urge your support of House File 47 so we can keep broadband expansion on track and ensure Minnesota remains a leader in connectivity. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wolf, for your testimony today. We've got a number of testifiers that are going to be coming up now to the microphone, and I think what we'll do is I'll have the next person come up, which is Brent Christensen. On deck will be Mr. Mark Muller. If you guys could just sort of, if you're on deck, make your way to the table while the other one is speaking. We're going to try to keep most testimony between 2-3 minutes or so. I'm not going to cut anybody off, but I do want to be sensitive to the time that we have and the number of testifiers that are here this morning. So Mr. Muller could come forward as well. With that, Mr. Christensen, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and carry on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. The MTA is a membership of mixed it's a mixed membership of cooperatives, family-owned companies, privately held, publicly traded broadband providers throughout Minnesota. While MTA members have different corporate structures, one thing we have in common is our commitment to serving Minnesota. Last year alone, my members invested nearly $300 million in private capital to expand broadband in Minnesota. And I'm here today in support of House File 47. And Mr. Chairman, let me start out by telling you what this bill is not. This bill is not anti-union. Several MTA members are union shops that employ over 750 union members. This bill is not a repeal of the hastily passed legislation from last year. It merely addresses just a few of the issues that are necessary to make our industry get into compliance. Let's also be clear that the law passed last year is not about safety. It's about creating a new education program. If it were strictly about safety, then it would be housed in the Office of Pipeline Safety and not the Department of Labor and Industry. If it were about safety, then it would apply to more than just the telecommunications industry. And if it were about safety, then it would apply to more than just locators and laborers. It would apply to backhoe operators and other heavy equipment operators, which can cause a whole lot more damage than a shovel. If this were about safety, then it would use the tools already in statute. Last year, the authority of the Office of Pipeline Safety was beefed up to address utility damage. In addition, nothing in our industry goes into the ground without local government permits. Those permitting authorities have the ability to require safe practices or pull the permit. That is where the efforts of more safe underground installation should be focused. Now, all that said, MTA has gone through the process to get our underground telecommunications installer certification program approved, or UTIC. MTA has a telecom-specific safety and education program that's been around since 1981. We provide training to over 3,000 employees in over 60 companies in 8 states. And even with all that experience and knowledge, our staff has struggled to come up with 40 hours of relevant content. And this makes sense if you consider that the UTIC program was patterned after the pipe layers certification, which is only 4 hours. Our goal for over 10 years has been to work with the state to provide true border-to-border broadband. This issue just doesn't affect Minnesotans in Carlstead or Byron or Pipestone, but it also affects Minnesotans in Minneapolis, Burnsville, and Savage. Members, I strongly urge you to support this bill. Let's fix this, and let's get back to the work of deploying quality broadband to all Minnesotans. And with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Next up, Mr. Mueller, and then on deck is Derek Leffert. Go ahead, Mr. Mueller, and proceed.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Mark Mueller, President of Telecom Construction, and a member of the PCCA and associate member of the MTA. My company is in the business of construction and communications plant, maintenance, repair, broadband engineering, and building management and construction, including interconnects for data centers. We support HF 47, Mr. Chairman, and will share testimony starting with the fact that we do not oppose the legislation passed last year mandating another industry compliance that is already regulated by OSHA, the One Call System, contractual standards, BEAD mandated safety programs, DOT requirements, required traffic plans, municipality, city, county requirements, and pipeline safety standards. We believe most of the issues brought to the industry last year were based on out-of-state contractors and their out-of-state subcontractors. They commonly work for the new CLEC companies that entering our market in Minnesota. Currently, with the issue they experienced, I see changes in their approach in using local Minnesota contractors, which will show great improvement for the new construction season. I'm also concerned the current legislation may also push Minnesota contractors out of this market into competing states. One very important issue would be the 811 one call system is not meeting its obligations. Our need with utility locates in the process that everyone is required to follow. In 2024, 50% of our locates were 1 to 2 days past due or longer. And this is a safety risk to the public and delays any and all work, including BEAD, and must be addressed. In 2024, just for one of our customers, Lumen in the state of Minnesota, we performed 13,620 work orders from service to homes and businesses, fiber to the home and businesses, and line extensions. Part of that work is damage work orders. There was 425 damages to the plant of Lumen last year alone that we responded to their plant to repair damages for other types of construction like gas, power, city utilities, road constructions with no pipeline safety investigation representing the communications. Our company at peak of the season has up to 1,000 personnel working with exceptional record under our safety training and practices. Telcom had in the state of Minnesota 17 at-fault damages and 18 not-at-fault damages. My partners who are in the room today throughout the state of Minnesota had that worked under the Lumen work also in addition, had 7 at-fault and 13 not-at-fault damages for a total of 18,000 work orders. That's a very, very good track record. Not that we want any of them to happen, but it's minimal if you look at the bigger picture for a safety record. We have our Minnesota DALI approved training course, Telcom-1-0207-2025, approved on 2725, including our instructors. This will be in addition to all OSHA, St. Cloud, Minnesota excavating training and operating quality operator qualified programs we already do at our training center in Clearwater. Today I ask that you take time to consider the current legislation as written. It does not accomplish more than what is being done already, but does create a standard. With our training history, the need is that we need a grandfather clause, existing employees that can pass our approved testing from the state and look to have the standards for new inexperienced people, the opportunity to a skill set that makes their quality of life better. Training for a day, as the city of St. Cloud did to prevent risk of damage and public safety, which is working, for a sufficient time to, and we also ask for a sufficient time to implement, correctly extend the July mandate for 12 months to July of 2026.
Start wrapping it up for me.
Yeah,
thank you.
I am done.
Thank you.
Right now, the current legislation will be a burden to the voting public of Minnesota. As you can see, many of them are here from around the state today. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Muller. I appreciate the testimony this morning. Mr. Lefford, and then on deck is Joel Hansen. Mr. Lefford, go ahead and proceed and introduce yourself and share your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Derek Lefford, for the record, head of government affairs for Gateway Fiber. We are a broadband provider and also an excavator that's working primarily in the MSP area. And it's my understanding, I just kind of want to provide some clarity on what we're doing. It was my understanding that we were specifically called out, so I wanted to make sure to set the record straight as it relates to what we do. Before I get into that, I will tell you that my role and my background prior to coming to Gateway Fiber was in the damage prevention industry. I led a lot of efforts legislatively, both in the state of Missouri as well as nationwide, on damage prevention legislation, and am considered a subject matter expert on this particular piece of legislation, and have been involved in conversations nationally and helped draft things nationally. I will tell you that as far as our damage prevention process, I know that we were specifically called out, but I wanted to provide clarity on that. We actually pioneered a kind of first of its kind in the United States, what we call a third-party auditing system, where our contractors, they submit their locate requests. Prior to them actually going out to begin their work, we actually pay a third-party auditor to actually go out audit the ticket, audit the marks on the site, audit the status of the tickets. They not only are they looking for abnormalities or inaccuracies, they're also looking for things that maybe haven't been marked or they're marked incorrectly. They take photographs of each and every single mark that's on the ground, doesn't matter whether it's an electric, gas, communication, whatever it is. They GPS each and every single mark. That's all mapped out and put into a system. Those third-party auditors are also on site while the excavation work occurs to monitor best practices and make sure that there's not any unsafe activity going on. So we invest a significant amount of money in that. I think in 2024 alone, we put over $1 million just simply into that particular process for the third-party auditing. So that equates to the damages that we had, the at-fault damages that we had in 2024. We put in 1.6 million feet of conduit and had 34 damages. Almost half of those damages were shovel strikes, where our contractors were trying to do the right thing. They weren't using mechanized equipment in the tolerance zone. They were trying to use to do the right thing, and for whatever reason got into it. So if you lump all those 34 at fault, that's one damage for every 9 miles of conduit that we put in the ground. If you take the shovel strikes into account, you remove those, it's one damage for every 16 miles of conduit that we put in the ground. I would put that record up against anybody, any contractor, and I would say that as a result of our efforts, you're starting to see more broadband providers nationally start to adopt that process, and hopefully some other folks here locally. As far as the issues within the system, I will tell you that our contractors consistently incur challenges within the system, and it's been addressed by Mr. Christensen and others. The contractors have a legal obligation to submit the locate request, and the utilities have a legal obligation to mark those locate requests and mark them accurately. And I will tell you that our production has been inhibited significantly, and the residents of Minnesota have suffered as a result of that because the utilities haven't done what they're supposed to do, and there is not an equitable mechanism for enforcement here in Minnesota. As far as this particular burden, it's going to increase costs over and above the ordinary costs of training, and those dollars aren't going to be able to be spent at reaching the unserved and underserved Minnesotans out there. I will tell you that just because of this particular piece of legislation, that does cause companies like us to take a second look on how much capital do we want to invest in a particular place. I will tell you that we're investing tens of millions of dollars in Minnesota right now and would like to continue to do that. But if we're unable to do that because there's some onerous provisions, we may look elsewhere into other markets to see whether or not that's a more suitable spot for our dollars. As they mentioned, 40 hours seems a bit excessive. You can take a look at a number of other states across the United States where there's OSHA 10 requirements. I think OSHA 10 makes sense because it's pretty comprehensive as far as safety is concerned. And, I think that probably a number of these contractors are used to dealing with this and have specific training programs. I know our contractors have training programs in place that would address all of these issues that are supposed to be addressed. And I will just kind of wrapping up, the construction workforce is very transient, right? And so if they have to continue to each and every single person that comes on board in any new hire, they have to update and train every single new person that comes on board. That's going to be a significant burden on small businesses, most of which are the contractors that are doing this sort of work. So I appreciate the time and would be happy to answer any questions or follow up with anybody else.
Thank you, Mr. Leffert. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Hansen, if you could come forward, please. And then on deck would be Michelle Benson. If you could take your position at the table as well so we keep things moving along. And to Mr. Hansen, go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker, members of the committee, Lee Pinto. My name is Joel Hansen. I'm the Director of Government Affairs with Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. We're happy to provide testimony today in support of House File 47. So by way of background, ABC of Minnesota is a construction industry trade organization with over 350 local members that promote fair and open competition in the construction industry. Our members employ over 20,000 men and women who are part of the 76% of the construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. And so following passage in 2024 of legislation governing the certification of underground telecommunication installers, ABC has worked to develop a DALI-approved Safety Qualified Underground Telecommunications Installer Certification Program. It's quite a mouthful, so we call it SQUIDI. ABC's program will be optional by early spring, and per the requirements of the legislation, it will require individuals that are seeking to become qualified to complete 40 hours of training, which includes both classroom and hands-on instruction, and pass an exam certifying their proficiency. Importantly, the program that ABC is developing is open to all underground telecommunications installers, regardless of labor or trade organization affiliation. And as far as we know, we're currently the only organization in the state that's developing a truly open SQUIDI program that meets DALI approval. So as such, we expect to take on a large share, perhaps the majority, of the individuals that need to complete this training program. We estimate the amount of individuals that will have to go through our program is at least 1,000, perhaps more. So taking into account Minnesota's abbreviated construction season, we fear that the telecommunication industry will not be able to certify every employee who needs to be certified prior to the July 1st, 2025 deadline. That's why we strongly support pushing back the deadline to January 1st of 2026, as this legislation does. This allows employers and employees a full construction season to get the certification and avoids any unintentional instances of breaking the law through an inability to complete the training on time or, worse yet, a loss of work for the employees and employers alike. Secondly, this was mentioned in Ms. Wolf's testimony, there's considerable amount of confusion right now regarding who needs this certification. Crucially, this needs to be clarified. However, based on DALI's current interpretation, the result could be potentially 1,000 more individuals that are going to need this certification, further exacerbating the problem that we've already highlighted, which is trying to get everyone certified prior to this deadline. And so, again, that's why we support the proposed changes on lines 1.17 and 2.1. Additionally, further clarification is needed from DALI regarding who needs this certification regarding the definition of location. So right now in the law, it says those who are at the site or on location need the certification. In the broadband industry, some job sites can be potentially miles long. So that's why we specifically support the strike through on lines 1.17 through 1.19. And then finally, I'll just bring up two issues that aren't currently found in this legislation, but Mr. Mueller in his testimony alluded to, ABC would support some sort of language that would have a grandfathering in clause for individuals who've already been in this industry for quite a while. We think if an individual can demonstrate that they've been in the industry and then pass a DALI certified test, one that ABC would offer to test out of the program, that would make some sense and again alleviate the pressure that we're looking at to get everyone certified in the industry before the deadline. And then lastly, DALI has raised the issue of all SQUIDI curriculum, regardless of who creates it, so us or a labor organization, being potentially public data. And so we would ask that there be some language that would make that private data, as every organization who's putting this together is spending considerable resources on this. So thanks again for the ability to support House File 47, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Ms. Benson, welcome to the testimony table. If you could introduce yourself, and then Toby Sunderland is on deck, if you'd please come forward. Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, and committee members. My name is Michelle Benson, and I'm the Director of Energy and Commerce Policy from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I appreciate the opportunity to support the changes in House File 47. The Chamber and our 6,300 members know that digital commerce and information infrastructure drives a vibrant, local, and globally competitive economy. Minnesota businesses require robust, modern, secure, and accessible communication, data, and information infrastructure, systems, and networks. And if your kids had an e-learning day this week, your kids needed that too. Direct investments, as well as critical regulatory frameworks in the digital ecosystem, impact Minnesota businesses. Minnesota's telecommunication providers have invested billions of dollars to build infrastructure, increasing access, speed, and availability for customers. In addition, public investment in broadband expansion has reached hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years, with significant additional funding already guaranteed over the next decade. There's broad bipartisan commitment to information infrastructure in Minnesota. This legislation amends last year's Underground Telecommunications Installer Certification Program, a training initiative for broadband contractors that added significant barriers to broadband deployment. Sensible adjustments in this bill will reduce existing regulatory barriers that impede a timely, efficient broadband deployment across Minnesota and will help ensure that available federal funding is deployed in benefit to Minnesotans. Thank you, Representative Schultz, his co-authors, and you committee members for considering and bringing forward this legislation, and to the advocates from across Minnesota who know that access to information infrastructure is essential for economic growth. Thank you for the bipartisan effort to accelerate information access into Minnesota's economy, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Mr. Sunderland, actually Nick Anderson, if you could also come to the testifying table, you'll be on deck. Mr. Sunderland, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you and good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Toby Sunderland. I am the regional construction manager at ARBIG, where I lead projects across the region from St. Cloud to Minneapolis-St. Paul and down to Rochester. With 27 years of experience in the underground utilities installation industry, I am here to firmly support Minnesota House File 47, which seeks to enhance the certification process for underground telecommunications installers. In today's interconnected world, the significance of reliable and efficient telecommunications infrastructure cannot be overstated. As technology evolves, the demand for high-speed internet and seamless connectivity is skyrocketing. Underground telecommunications infrastructure is essential for fulfilling this demand and ensuring that our communities and businesses have the services they require. The installation of underground telecommunications infrastructure is indeed a complex and delicate task that demands specialized knowledge, skills, and a strong adherence to safety standards. Minnesota House File 47 addresses these challenges head-on by modifying the certification provisions, making the process more straightforward and less financially burdensome without compromising its integrity. Many of the requirements outlined in Statute Section 326B 198 Subdivisions 2 and 3, which is about the certification program, are largely redundant, simply reiterating existing laws. Minnesota State Law Chapter 216D establishes the one-call excavation notice system, while Minnesota Rules Chapter 7560 creates the Office of Pipeline Safety, which enforces these one-call laws. At ARBIG, we actively engage with these organizations by inviting them to our annual spring kickoff meetings in Perham, Minnesota, and we value their participation and their insightful presentations that they provide to our teams each year. I can confidently say that extending these training presentations to 40 hours offers minimal additional benefit. I can speak from myself and my own experience that 40 hours can get you a pilot's license. House File 47 seeks to streamline the certification process, making it more manageable while retaining its essential standards. As a representative of ARBIG, I can attest to the robust monitoring and recording capabilities of our fiber network throughout the 2024 calendar year. Our systems meticulously tracked and documented nearly all instances of network damage, providing us with invaluable data and insights into the cause and frequencies of these incidents. And the data paints a clear picture. A significant majority of our network disruptions are preventable. Our records indicate that over 60% of all damages sustained in 2024 were directly attributed to the incomplete or inaccurate utility locates. This highlights a critical need for improving communication and precision in the utility locating process. When these locates were flawed, our underground utility cables become vulnerable and accidentally struck during excavation and construction activities. While inaccurate locates represent the large single cause of damage, the remaining incidents are distributed across several other categories. Contractor accidents independent from inaccurate locates accounted for a portion of the damage, but also vehicle accidents where vehicles directly impacted our above ground infrastructure, weather-related events such as severe storms causing trees to fall or flooding, and as well as wildlife. Having fiber network in the Gopher State has also resulted in some damages to our network. These remaining categories are spread fairly evenly, representing a smaller yet still significant portion of our total incidents. The data gathered through 2024 was and has been instrumental in helping us identify areas of improvement where we are actively working to address the issues of inaccurate utility locates through increased communication with our relevant stakeholders, advocating for better mapping technologies and exploring preventative measures to safeguard our fiber network. Expenditures that ensure the presence of no fewer than two safety-qualified underground telecommunications installers at all times at any location where telecommunication infrastructure is being installed by means of directional drilling focuses on the smaller portion of our network damages. This money could be allocated to more pertinent locating training, installation of safeguards, and the acquisition of equipment and technologies that increase the safety of our of these types of excavations. Together, we can uphold the integrity of our telecommunications network and prioritize the public interest. I strongly urge you to support House File 47 as a critical step forward towards improving the reliability and safety of our underground telecommunications infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sunderland, very much for your testimony. Next up, Nick Anderson, and on deck is Kevin Prentice. Go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I'm Nick Anderson. I'm the Director of Operations at Anderson Underground. We're a Minnesota company based in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota, employing 40 people. Our parent company is Selenric Holdings. They have a 45-year history in providing telecommunication services throughout the country, and they employ 430 people. Our organization provides telecommunication infrastructure services in the Seven County metro area, as well as outstate Minnesota, and will be directly affected by Statute 326B.198. We feel that the intent of this legislation is good, and we agree with the damage prevention focus, but strongly believe there are problems with the implementation that need to be addressed without delay. We, like many other companies in the room, are active members of the Power and Communication Contractors Association. I myself am a board member, and this organization has helped its members establish Department of Labor recognized underground utility installer technician apprenticeship programs, of which we are enrolled. The apprenticeship program requires participants to complete a classroom component as well as a competency-based field demonstrated skill set. This type of training is recognized by the Department of Labor at the federal level, and we feel it should also be recognized at the state level as a qualifier for certification. Without some allowances for current proven qualified workers to do their jobs, we are at risk of delaying projects and pushing an already depleted workforce out of the state. Additionally, our company's CEO, Steve Selenric, is a Common Ground Alliance board member. We use CGA best practices in our daily operations. Their approach involves all stakeholders in the damage prevention process and not just the contractors. Through industry initiatives, CGA has set a goal of 50% reduction in utility damages over the next 5 years. Our company has internally documented a 90% decrease in at-fault utility hits and a 60% overall decrease on gateway fiber projects specifically by using these best practices. If damage prevention is a true driver of the original statute 326B198, as stated in the North Star Digging Into Danger report, all stakeholders, contractors, utility owners, locating companies, and municipalities need to be a part of this solution and should strongly consider joining the Common Ground Alliance and participating in the Damage Prevention Institute and adopting their best practices. We feel immediate changes need to be made to this law to keep projects on track. Our request is to recognize Federal Department of Labor registered apprenticeship programs as a means of contractor qualification. Also, we'd like to see all stakeholders join the CGA and participate in their Damage Prevention Institute. Without the recommended changes, contractors will leave the state, jeopardizing project timelines and needed broadband deployment.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Mr. Prentice, welcome to the committee. And then on deck is Aaron Rosenthal. And that'll be our last known testifier. I will ask the question to the public if anybody else wants to submit any testimony today in a very short manner. We can take that as well. Just let us know and raise your hand so we can get to you. So, Mr. Prentice, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Kevin Prentice, on behalf of LIUNA, Minnesota, North Dakota, we represent 14,000 men and women who do construction work on building, civil, and energy and telecom infrastructure projects. It's a pleasure to be here today. I want to thank Representative Schultz for his engagement with us, and I especially want to thank Representative Berg, who carried the original bill last year. I think, as I listen to the testimony, it's kind of an incredible moment for us because I think we realized we did a really good thing last year, the legislature did, and we're now here talking about what's the best way to do that good thing, and that's a good conversation to be having. I appreciate that there is an acknowledgement, you know, this year that we didn't hear last year, that there's a real problem that we're solving. And my favorite testimony so far was the representative from Telecom, I'm going to get his name wrong, Mr. Mueller, talking about how this law has already resulted in the broadband providers relying more on capable local contractors and less on some of the fly-by-night out-of-state contractors that have been such a problem in the industry. I do want to be clear that it is not only the out-of-state contractors that are having some problems, right? The truth is, in a highly competitive industry, a rotten apple can ruin the barrel. Right, and I am no way suggesting that like the folks in this room are not highly capable and professional, but we all know that the best contractor in the world, when faced with a bid that's half as much, and the question, why can't you meet that bid, is going to have to figure out some way to cut some corner to make it work. And so I think what we're doing here is saying what the standard should be. I just want to clarify some misconceptions about the bill from last year. It was actually based on a year's worth of research that we did before bringing that bill at all, interviews with workers, contractors, energy utilities, state and local officials. And what we found was incredibly high rates of turnover, too little training, frequent accidents that have been documented, and you'll hear about from Mr. Rosenthal. And what we've heard in the conversation since then is really troubling. Cities feeling completely overwhelmed by the amount of substandard broadband installation that they have to hire additional inspectors. You see a letter in your document from the city of Austin. That story is the same story we have heard from probably a dozen cities and counties, especially in the metro, but clearly not only in the metro area, that are overwhelmed by poor quality installation, felt they had no tools. And so we've been thanked by all these people that we didn't know, who didn't know about the law, for making something happen, and they want to see this law move forward as expeditiously as possible, and I think we share that goal. I want to be clear that the existing regulatory requirements, there's all sorts of OSHA requirements, MNOPs, right? What we learned was there was big loopholes in between those. In other words, yes, there are OSHA requirements. Those don't protect the public. They're designed to protect workers. So if you hit a gas line and it leaks into a house for days and eventually explodes, that's not an OSHA issue, right? That's completely separate. Now, it's a MNOPs issue, but MNOPs has very limited powers in what it can do and no ability to hold the broadband companies responsible, right, and make sure the responsible ones are successful. And so I think that's an important thing to understand. Basically, our view is that things are going very well so far. The Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry has done a fantastic job of quickly processing programs. The fact that you heard from ABC, the sort of anti-union contractor association, and you're hearing from unions that we are all in this field, we are all providing training, that's really should be good news for everybody. This was an open access system, and DLI has processed at an amazing speed, you know, set up those requirements and processing those trainings. And we still have a long way to go until July 1st. There are many training days available. We already have our first class in training now. We have indoor facilities. Probably some other people have indoor facilities. But even without indoor facilities, there's going to be a lot of days when that training can be done. And we're happy to see so many parties doing that training. We absolutely agree on the question of locates, but I want to point out that we have a disproportionate problem in telecom of excavator error that you'll hear about from Mr. Rosenthal, and also when the locates are bad, which we agree is a problem we should fix, having capable contractors is the best way to make sure that a bad locate doesn't turn into a bad, dangerous incident, right? Because if you're properly excavating, hopefully you find that, you figure out that the locate was in the wrong place before you've actually destroyed something. In terms of the bill, I think first that the exemption of installation of residential services could mean that some of the most potentially dangerous accidents, the worst case is in a home where the gas leaks, gets nicked on the line, leaks into that home, could go on for days before it's realized and something happens. And the utilities have been quite clear, you cannot count on 3 feet being safe ground with no utilities, nor can we assume that people won't accidentally go below 3 feet. And I'm appreciative that Minnesota Cable is open to changing that. Second, there's a big difference between 10 hours of training and 40. Frankly, we struggled to just to get all the material into 40 hours. I don't understand what people want to cut out in order to sort of get it down to 10, but we believe that all of those elements are essential, and we haven't seen a plan that says, well, here's what we're going to cut loose, right? Here's what we're not going to train in that's critical to safety, because we don't think that we have the time to do that. I will say that our pipe layers are the majority of all pipe layers in the state. They get 80 hours of training. And just to point on other industries, every other underground utility construction industry is more highly regulated than the telecom industry. There's prevailing wage protections on almost all of the underground water and sewer work that happens in this state. You have all kinds of regulation on the gas and electric utilities. So I don't think any contractor will find it easier or simpler or require less training to move into those other industries. Finally, I think in terms of who's covered by the law, I think it's pretty clear. DLI, I think, has actually been quite clear and consistent on this, but we are very open. We've indicated that with to getting together with contractors and going through scenarios and saying, I got five drills and I got two crews doing locates, and who exactly do you think is supposed to be trained here? I think that's very appropriate because counties and cities are eager to enforce this, and we'd like to see that consistent. We're waiting for Minnesota Cable and MTA to pull together those contractors, and we're happy to have that conversation whenever needed, and we're certainly happy to talk about the date. But I will say we haven't really seen the math and the plan about either why we can't get it done by July 1st just in the metro. And I would point out that almost none of that federal broadband funding is going to be deployed in the seven-county metro, very, very little of it. So that July 1st date does not in any way impede our ability to access or execute on BEAD funding. Available for questions, and thanks for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Prentice. Appreciate it. Mr. Rosenthal, and that concludes our testimony that we have signed up. So go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Rosenthal, and I serve as the research director for North Star Policy Action. We are an independent research and communications institute dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. Last year, we conducted an analysis of the damage done to underground infrastructure in Minnesota in the years 2020 to 2022, and what we found was alarming. Telecommunications installation was the leading cause of damage to buried infrastructure in Minnesota by a substantial margin, averaging more than one strike per day. This telecom-induced damage was not only more common, but also generally done to essential utilities, including nearly half of telecom hits occurring to natural gas lines. The scale of telecom damage looks even more troubling when focusing on specific types of work that are shared across utilities. 60% of all damage taking place in Minnesota during directional drilling came from telecom installation. While telecom, electric, and natural gas utilities all engage in directional drilling, telecom accounted for twice as many damage incidents as electric and gas utilities combined. Telecom's drilling damage is also distinct in terms of the source of error, where more than three-quarters of drilling hits from natural gas and electric are attributed to locator error. Nearly half of all telecom damage came from excavator errors, indicating mistakes made by people doing the drilling. Where our report focused on 2020 to 2022, we are currently updating our analysis to include newly available data from 2023. Far from indicating a declining issue, it would appear that things got worse for telecom installation in 2023. Our analysis, which we'll be publishing soon, suggests that telecom has made up a growing share of underground damage year over year, including an increasing number of strikes to natural gas lines and particularly large jumps in damage from directional drilling and excavator errors. Last year, the legislature took a big step forward in addressing what we found to be a serious public safety and worker safety problem in passing the broadband safety bill. Our analysis showing that telecom installation remains a significant and growing source of damage suggests that this would be the exact wrong time to undo that progress. Thank you, and I look forward to any questions you may have.
Thank you. thank you, Mr. Rosenthal, for your testimony. Anyone from the audience would like to participate with a testimony here? Seeing none, I will close. One of them in the corner, if you want to come forward. Again, if we can do 2 to 3 minutes, and then we'll close testimony to the public because I want to move to member questions. So welcome to the testifying table, sir. If you could introduce yourself and go ahead, 2 to 3 minutes.
My name is Jason Clare. I work for STF Services. We're a small company that actually does the work that you all are talking about. And so when we have certain strikes that happen, I would say 95%, because I track them all at our company, are because of locates being off. They all cause us downtime. We have to eat that. there's no way for us to recoup that from the utility that didn't mark their utilities. So we already have that expense going on. The class that MTA is offering very generously to everybody is going to cost us about $800 looking at per person. We have a lot of employees in this industry that they come to work, they work for maybe a week, they quit. They work for 2 days, they quit. It's a very transient, as somebody else said. So if we have to run them through 40 hours of training before they can even start working, pay the fees for that, and then they quit after a week of actual work, you know, that gets to be a very expensive for small companies. And also I'd like to address the line 1-11 where the numbers are talked about who has to be trained. That wording says anybody that's exposing or that's locating an existing utility. In small companies, everybody jumps in and works. When if you're a drill operator, when you're not drilling, you're potholing or doing other things like that, which is exposing the utilities. Everybody in our company and every other small company here will have to get certified. So it's not just one or two people per crew, like the law tries to pretend it is. It's everybody. So that cost, that time, we have to eat it all. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clare. I appreciate your testimony. All right. I'll go ahead and close public testimony, and we are going to move to member questions. Representative Berg, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I heard in testimony was that having certified workers is a burden. And I want to share something. Most of you in this room know I'm a flight attendant when I'm not doing the job here. And I have a license from the FAA that says I am certified in the safety in operating on an aircraft. And for people that are familiar with what just happened in Toronto, that was my plane. Those are my friends, my crew members. That's a flight I do all the time. And so when you look at what happened in that crash, it landed, and then the right wing dipped onto the runway, sheared off. And the fact that aircrafts store the fuel in the wings, which keeps it away from the passengers and the fuselage, as well as balances out the aircraft, and that's how you get to have your steady wings. So that sheared off, and there was a fireball, and it came to a stop once it flipped over. And so once that happened, the crew were evacuating passengers in an upside-down plane that was on fire, and 80 people evacuated and were alive today because those flight crews were certified in a safety-sensitive job. And I can tell you, nobody is mad at the amount of training that that flight crew had. Nobody that left that plane alive, their loved ones, nobody is mad about the amount of training we do and the certifications we have. And we train year round. I have to do computer training quarterly. I have to go in and do a full day of training with drills on how to handle situations exactly like that. That is what it means to be a safety sensitive certified worker. And that bill that we did last year was about the safety of not only the workers, but the communities. Whether or not you care, if a worker strikes a natural gas line and there's an explosion and that worker loses their life, whether or not you care if your neighbor is walking by and gets caught up in that explosion, or that the house that you're working in front of explodes with a family inside, whether or not you care about all of that matters. And the fact that you say all stakeholders were not engaged, they were lengthy and heavy negotiations for that bill. And so I guess my question to either Ms. Wolf or any of the testifiers that are in favor of this bill, what exactly would you eliminate out of those 40 hours of training to get it down to 10 hours? And how does that make our workers and our community and our existing infrastructure safer?
Representative Schultz, or do you want to call up a testifier maybe? Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Berg. I'm very grateful for all the training that the flight attendants have and the service that they provide as a frequent flyer. I would say the answer to your question is really the reverse.
what training is required to dig a hole, and how do you fill that with 40 hours? What we don't know is we don't know how those damages are caused. Are they caused with a shovel? Are they caused with a directional boring machine? Are they caused with a backhoe or a plow? The backhoe and the plow are not required to have any training at all. So I think 10 hours, honestly, is even too much. But 40 hours in filling that with the training, I think the goal here is to have reasonable training that can get competent people doing the job, as you suggested. I do take exception with the comment about the stakeholders and the process last year. There were conversations, and we were involved in it, but we were told what was going to happen. We didn't have any input. And so I think what we need to do is provide training and certifications that is qualified, mm-hmm. appropriate, and measured. And as I said in my testimony, I do not believe this belongs in the Department of Labor and Industry. If we're talking about safety and we're talking about gas explosions and the things that you're talking about, we have the Office of Pipeline Safety, and that's their job. If they don't have all the tools, as Mr. Prentice suggested, I think we need to work to get them the tools they need to do the job. I disagree with them. I think they do have the tools. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Berg.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer, I guess. I think that there are a lot of people in this room that are part of the skilled trades, and each one of them will tell you how incredibly important it is to be certified in the safety standards of your trade. This bill, this makes workers less safe, our communities less safe, and I don't think that there is a lack of clarity in the bill that we did last year that this addresses. And again, I think if we're taking safety seriously, both in our communities and with our existing infrastructure, this bill does nothing to address that. Thank you.
Representative Pete Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing this issue forward. Rep. Berg stole a little bit of what I was going to use, but I take offense to the discrediting of workers saying that this is 40 hours to use a shovel. The reason that I'm actually here today is when my career started with the Duluth Fire Department 20 years ago, we had a city councilor that said, really all the fire department does is hold doors open for the ambulance. So when we discredit workers, any worker, it is an insult to them. It is an insult to all the workers that are actually out there every day doing it. So that is what drove me to get involved in politics and ultimately why I'm here today. And looking at what the requirements are, the training, need and use for utility operations, regulations applicable to excavating, including but not limited to equipment excavation, hand digging, hydro evacuation, the use of techniques for flagging and traffic control in work areas, occupational health and safety standards, and how to properly protect workers, how to avoid and or mitigate any hazards associated with underground utility installations, the requirements for working in a confined space such as manholes, the understanding of horizontal directional drilling operations, including use of tracking devices to safely guide the drill, the proper response to responding to a line strike or other incident, other information as needed for specifics of the installation, and finally, be able to demonstrate knowledge of course material by successfully completing an exam. That sounds more to me than 40 hours teaching somebody how to use a shovel. So I would reiterate the question that Representative Berg asked. Of those 10 standards or outcomes, which one should be eliminated to speed up this process?
To the testifiers, who wants to go ahead and take that?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Wolf? Or,
let me just, sorry.
Okay.
Let me start. Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I apologize to you if I gave you any kind of inclination that I do not hold someone who uses a shovel with respect or labor. That's how I started almost 30 years ago in this industry. I started off at the business end of the shovel. I'm not saying that we eliminate any of those things. I'm saying that you don't have 40 hours is too much time to get that job done. You can get that job done in a lot less time and still keep all of those standards.
Ms. Wolf, did you want to comment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Berg and Representative Johnson. So first, I do want to say, just to level set, that every broadband contractor in this room takes safety very seriously. It is paramount for all of these people in this room and our companies. They all want to go home to their families at night, and we want them to as well. So I want to level set that safety is their number one issue, and it is ours. I also agree with Brent that if you look at the bill, we are not taking away anything that's in the law that is required for this training. What we're saying is we don't need 40 hours to complete it. Everything that's listed in the law, all of those six things that I think you just read out, will be completed, will be part of those approved curriculums by DLI. We just don't need 40 hours to complete it.
Representative Johnson, a follow-up? Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard reference to DLI a couple of times, so I'd like to give the agency a chance to come up and speak to a couple of questions.
Welcome to the committee, to the department. If you could introduce yourself. I want to give kind of a layout just a bit to the members of the committee here. We do have another bill, and I want to try to get to that at about 22. So just kind of just scale it up. But welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sean O'Neill. I serve as the Assistant Director for the Construction Codes and Licensing Division at DLI.
Welcome, Mr. O'Neill. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Neill, one of the references that I'm reacting to is that some of the folks that testify said there's some inconsistent guidance from DLI. Can you speak to the guidance that's been provided to individuals, the stakeholders involved here?
Mr. O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, certainly. The guidance that we've been giving out to our stakeholders has been consistent, in my opinion. The reference in regards that Ms. Wolf made in regards to a misstatement in a recent webinar is accurate, regrettably. However, I interjected after that statement was made and reassured the stakeholders that that was going to be addressed and further fleshed out in our FAQ document that the department has available for stakeholders online on our website. So that is in progress. And with further context, I did interject and reassured our stakeholders that always going to be corrected. That guidance in regards to who needs to be certified on a job site has been shared with many of the stakeholders that are opposed to this legislation previously, as this was given to DLI to implement after the last session. And what we do is we heard loud and clear from stakeholders in the industry that they didn't want DLI to be a barrier to getting people certified and out working. And I feel very confident that we've been moving very swiftly on this and reassured our stakeholders that if there's any gray area in regards to interpretation of the statute, we are going to lean towards the more flexible interpretation.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you for that answer, Ms. O'Neill. One other question. There's been a lot of reference to the amount of hours and what's in that training. Can you speak to what's in the actual 40-hour training that's going to be required?
Mr. O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, certainly. Starting with sections 2.15 of the bill, going down to 2.22, our staff member that's entrusted to review the training programs that DLI has received, his role is to ensure that the training programs address these scopes of works and they are included in the training curriculum. And if that isn't done with the programs that he's reviewing, he's instructed to reach out to those stakeholders because we want to say yes. We want to get people approved and we want people working. So that is part of his review process. We also, on our department website, we also have an FAQ document that is live, and we've been receiving questions from stakeholders. We try and act quickly on that and push the correct interpretation out so people are getting a common uniform response from the department. Also, we have a sample curriculum online and the standards that we take into account when we're looking at these training programs before we give it approval.
Representative Frazier.
One last question. How many training programs have been approved to this point, if you know?
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frazier. We've approved 7 training programs to date, and we have just received one extra one today, which is currently under review.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been an interesting conversation. Some of us were in this committee a year ago when we passed Representative Berg's bill. There were two bills, actually. There was one about expanding for prevailing wage. There was one with the safety recommendations. Both were strongly opposed by the industry. And in last year, we heard a lot of testimony about how there wasn't a problem. And I am wondering, as we think about now, like that's not uncommon. When we heard the Refinery Safety Act bill, we heard there wasn't a problem with safety or safety of for the community. When we heard the Meat Packers bill, we heard there wasn't a problem with this industry practices. When we heard the Warehouse Worker Safety Act, we heard from Amazon there wasn't a problem. And in all of these cases, both the data and the workers who are doing the work said differently. So I guess I'm wondering, and what I heard from Mr. Christensen is this bill's not about safety and that even 10 hours of training is too much. I'm wondering, Representative Schultz, as the author of the bill, one, do you actually believe we have a problem to solve? And two, do you think 10 hours of training is too much?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenman. I appreciate the notions that you brought up and the conversation around safety, communities, and workers, and our contractors. And key to your question is what you heard in testimony from other contractors today, which is with how transient this group of workers are in this field doing this work across the entire state, we need to have the flexibility together to ensure that we're still getting broadband installed across this state. And if that length of time is too long for employees who come in and then leave the job, which I don't think is the desire of any one of us, if they are moving too quickly in and out, that could deter contractors from being able to effectively meet the mission and the goal that we're going to have with BEAD, and ultimately serving the contracts that they're needing to meet. So it's about balance, and that's what I'm seeking to find with this bill.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure I heard whether you actually think we have a problem to solve. I will say, and the last testifier talked a lot about a transient and a high turnover workforce. To me, that is an argument for more training, because when we have folks who are coming in and out, we actually need to make sure that they are familiar with Minnesota standards. I know that what we heard in the last a year ago was one of the issues in this industry is a lot of folks who are coming out of state work, folks who are not trained. I think we heard actually from one of the testifiers that passage of this bill has already led to more local work, which is great, but that issue specifically about having folks, I think that there was testimony that maybe are a week on the job, to me that makes the case for a training program. And again, I'm wondering, I've heard a lot from cities who are talking about just the issue of strikes. I don't believe there's a publicly available data per contractor and per company about how many strikes are happening. But I think what we're hearing anecdotally from cities, what we saw, we had the Centerpoint letter, which I do not believe was in our packet, but I think it's on the website. I didn't. Centerpoint wrote very concerned. The testimony we had from workers last year, and I know we have lots of folks in the room, talked about a growing problem, and as we're doing more growing, we're doing more broadband installation, hearing from Mr. Rosenthal that there is an increasing problem, not a decreasing problem. I am still wondering, one, do you think we have a problem to solve, and do you think 10 hours is enough of that training, especially for that highly transient workforce?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Baker and Representative Greenman. I think that this conversation needs to be had with the stakeholders in the room over exactly what that is. And the reason being is because think about the costs that are incurred that were referenced earlier for every individual employee. And Representative Greenman, you might even have the data on exactly how many workers work in this space. I've been told, again, a little bit more anecdotally, that it's between the 5,000 to 7,000 Minnesotans work in broadband installation. And if there is an $800 cost for every single one of them, what is the result going to be to our constituents in their bill for internet? Or are they going to see the installation to their communities, whether it's in Minneapolis, whether it's in Mille Lacs? What happens if they have less service because the regulations that we have in place work against ultimately getting the installations made to serve Minnesotans? And that's the balance that I think we need to strike, and I'm committed to working on this session.
Final follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I think when worker and community safety come into play, it can't balance against safety. You can't balance against a community that could be affected if a gas line is struck. The balance to me of $800, I mean, we could talk, telecom is an incredibly profitable industry. If you want to talk about a surcharge on telecom to pay for these trainings, I would love to do that. I don't think we should ever put profit over the safety of people and communities. And so if the concern is that we have small businesses, small contractors who want to provide this training and can't, then we should talk about how to fund it. But what I hear from the telecom industries, oftentimes what we hear from industries that have high OSHA violations or high worker safety, which is we really care about the safety of our workers. We really care about the safety of our communities. But the data shows otherwise, and that's what this bill was intended to do. The last thing I just ask, I guess, my last question, you know, I know DLI to be a worker safety organization because that's where OSHA is, right? Most of our worker safety, most of our safety regulations go through OSHA. Mr. Christensen says otherwise. I'm wondering, Representative Schultz, do you think this bill was intended to be about safety, or was there some ulterior motive, which I think I sort of feel like Mr. Christensen was alluding to?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 47 is about making sure that we have the right balance so that we are seeing this broadband installation to benefit all Minnesota communities, including contractors, workers, and especially the people who need strong, affordable broadband access. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
They said it was the final one.
It was my final one, but I don't think that's – thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
That was not – sorry, if there's any confusion because there's two bills we're talking about. The bill I was talking about, and I think the bill Mr. Christensen was talking about, was Representative Berg's bill that was negotiated, that was passed, that included these 40 hours of training, included the provisions. That's the bill that I think Mr. Christensen was referring to, said was not about safety. And I am just wondering – I know you've been working on this issue and you're talking about sort of the conversations you're having. Do you believe that bill was about safety? And do you believe that we have a problem of safety in this industry?
Representative Schultz, I think you answered it, but try again.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My words speak for themselves.
Representative Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and I know we're tight on time. This will be quick. One just clarification, Representative Greenman referenced it. I think there were letters in opposition or of concern from CenterPoint Energy and Xcel that were on the website. They're not in our packets. Maybe just an oversight, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It was. Actually, if you notice, we have a new CLA here today. Our current one got called out. She had a brand-new baby grandson, so they flew out of town, so that was kind of a good thing. We apologize. It actually is on the website.
Yes.
It will be forwarded to all members. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. That's our mistake. Thank you.
And thank you, Chair, and totally understandable, and best wishes to her and her family.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you for that.
So I guess just some comments here. We definitely do have a problem. I mean, as Representative Berg referenced, I really would encourage folks to look at this North Star Policy Action Packet that is in our materials. More than one strike a day on underground infrastructure in the telecom industry, and that's an undercount very likely because the data is incomplete. Nearly half of those strikes are on natural gas lines, which raises significant concerns. And underground telecom installation is the most frequent source of damage to both natural gas and electric lines in the state. That's going to become a bigger problem, of course, in future years. And information there, and then building on that, then, is those letters from CenterPoint Energy. So it's not just the 70,000 skilled construction workers in the building trades. It's CenterPoint Energy and Xcel expressing concern as well about this, and we definitely have a problem. And then just the letter from Austin Utilities, and I would really encourage everybody to take a look at it. To my mind, it really undermines the claim about that sort of every single contractor is very concerned. I'm sure many, many are, and maybe every single one in this room is, but the idea that every single contractor is so concerned with safety, Austin Utilities tells us they have horrible experiences with employees that are inexperienced and untrained with these installation contractors operating in an unsafe manner, quote, hitting our facilities, including gas, far more often than should happen. And in fact, the Prairie Land Utility Coordinating Committee, which is throughout Minnesota, saying that they're really trying to figure out what they can do to get telecom contractors to get them operate safer. They encourage and are very supportive of the 40-hour safety course. So we have a problem, and I guess it undermines the this bill to my mind as well, even just that question that was asked, how much training is required to dig a hole, was, I think, the exact words that were used. This is in our communities. Like, this is a real danger. We have to make sure that people who are doing this work know what they are doing. And when the statements in support, some of those statements in support are kind of undermining that, to my view, that undermines this bill. So, Representative Schultz and members, we've got the building trades members, we've got CenterPoint Energy, we've got Xcel, we've got Austin Utilities. And we just have our common sense that when there's training to put in lines, we want to make sure that there's training to not hit those lines in our homes and our communities. So I would urge members to vote no. Mr. Chair, would respectfully request a roll call when we are passing the bill.
Roll call has been requested. Thank you. And our final member question would be Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. And just so much to build off of here, and I know we're running short on time. I just wanted to reiterate, you know, that I heard the good work that we did last year and that this is the exact wrong time to claw it back. You know, I was a kid that grew up, just bringing us back to the heart of why we're here is broadband and for Minnesotans. I was a kid that grew up without the laptop, without the computer at home, and how much that held me back in education and in life. And I know that our communities have a lot of kids, have a lot of families who are driving to McDonald's, who are getting on the bus, you know, to go use Wi-Fi, especially out in greater Minnesota. And also, I'm struck that, you know, there's this sort of like the sentiment that I've heard is like this is just kind of the cost of doing business, and even a veiled threat of like, well, we'll leave if we don't weaken these safety laws. But what I'm also struck is that Minnesotans desperately need broadband, but not on the backs of when we're investing public dollars, both at the state and federal level, and on the backs of workers. And so I'm really interested, you know, there was a comment I heard, and I think that comes out in the reports and the letters that we've seen from Austin and other cities who are clamoring for us to do something, to give our communities tools to enforce and make sure that workers, thank you, Representative Johnson and Berg, go home safe to their families at the end of the night. There was a data that I heard that, you know, the best data that we would stand by the numbers is one damage for every 9 excavation and one damage for every 16 times out with the shovel. Well, I don't think it takes a huge amount with calculation that still 11% and 6%, and that's a lot more than zero. And so my question is for DLI. In terms of being on track for the July 1st deadline and installing and training, can you remind us and reiterate, are there hurdles that you are experiencing or in terms of the progress towards making sure that we are ready to go July 1st to ensure that this is rolled out and implemented?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. From DLI's standpoint, we feel that we've done all we've been entrusted to do in regards to pushing the information out, educating stakeholders, the public in regards to the legislation. We turn around program submissions within 30 days. We had originally started at a 60-day time frame. We cut that down to 30 because, again, we don't want to get in the way of progress, and we don't want to hold up job sites. So we do not see any issue with the current staggered rollout of the legislation as is.
Thank you. Nothing further, Representative Kozlowski?
Just one quick question, Chair. I'm curious, from the telecoms communication, what steps have you taken or undertaking to meet the July 1st deadline?
Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So as soon as this bill passed last session, we reached out to all of our member companies and had them reach out to all of their contractors. My member companies work with contractors, but they also have in-house construction teams that will have to complete this. And last summer, we met with DLI in August to, again, try to clarify who needs this. And what their plan was for letting people know in the field, because this is a group of industry that has never had to be before the Department of Labor and Industry before. So we did our due diligence to make sure our contractors knew that they had to be compliant with this law by July 1st. And we immediately started working on developing with them a compliant program. And that work started last September. And we have had task force meetings with all of our contractors in putting together this program. We submitted a preliminary program to DLI in November, which had preliminary approval, and we are working with our curriculum developer now to finalize that, and we'll resubmit it to DLI and hopefully get a curriculum number in early spring. And then at that point, we will have to first train the trainers because this program did not exist anywhere else in the country. We don't have a group of trainers that we can pull from, so we have to have them complete the program and pass the test at least 80% before they can then start actually training our workers. So we started immediately after this bill was passed. I also just want to point out, like I mentioned in my testimony, for my membership only, we think it's 1,000 to 1,500. That does not include the Minnesota Telecom Alliance members. That does not include any other broadband installer in the state that is doing work that is not part of Minnesota Cable or MTA. Yesterday, we spoke with a group, which has a letter in your packet as well, that just found out that this bill passed and represents 140 utility companies. So there are people that will be coming out of the woodwork once, they find out that they need to be compliant with this law.
Thank you, members, for the dialogue and conversation. Lead Pinto, I'm going to kind of strip you of your motion because you're not able to, I don't think, make that motion. So I'm just going to say, could Representative Berg or someone else make the motion so we do the roll call officially? We'll make sure that's happening, but I didn't mean to do that, but thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to call a roll call.
Yeah, roll call has been moved. Members, before I take the roll call, Representative Schultz, final closing comments quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for all of the testifiers today and the member discussion that we've had. Let's find the right balance that works for everyone in this space. I think that we can do that on a bipartisan basis successfully this session. This bill does not remove safety requirements from this program. This bill is about making this work for the people of Minnesota so that they can benefit from quality, strong, accessible, affordable broadband. That's the goal, and I encourage support of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Schultz. And again, Representative Schultz renews his motion to move this House File 47 onto the Agriculture Committee. A roll call has been requested. The chair votes aye.
Representative Meckland.
Aye.
Representative Bakeberg.
Aye.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Hussein. No. Representative Johnson. Peter.
Aye. No.
Pete. Oh, Pete. Sorry.
No.
Representative Johnson Wayne.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Representative Zlesnikar.
Aye.
Members, thank you for that. We have 7 ayes and 6 nays. The House File 47 is on its way to agriculture. Thank you very much for your testimony today, and we'll move on to the next bill. Representative Pete Johnson, please go to the testifying table.
And folks, if you're going to make your way out, we're going to keep moving, so try to keep it as quiet as you can so we can proceed. Thank you.
Who's that last guy that wasn't actually on the testifier list?
O'Neill. It's O'Neill from Department of Labor.
Okay.
I don't know his title.
I'll figure it out.
Where's what?
Apparently, I'm so excited.
Surprise, surprise.
I will.
All right, members. Members, we have House File 335 in front of us with our first time representative here presenting his very first bill. So welcome to this, Pete Johnson, Representative Johnson. Also, members, I want to say too that because of our printer malfunction or the ability to push the print button on a regular basis, we have another letter that's attached to this in support of Rep. Johnson's bill today. So I want to make sure that that's clarified. It's in an email. I wanted to make sure that we recognize that as well. So with that, Representative Johnson, welcome to your committee. House File 335 will be considered for possible future consideration, will be laid over today. Representative Johnson, please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. House File 335 is a bipartisan effort to keep the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program operating so that it can continue to deliver investments to Greater Minnesota. For members that may not be really familiar with this program, let me offer a little bit of background. This program came out of an effort from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities in 2002 and was passed by the legislature and enacted in 2003. Since 2010, $75 million have been awarded to Greater Minnesota counties and cities through 167 individual BDPI grants, creating more than 5,000 new jobs and retaining nearly 10,000. With this program, DEED is given the authority to make grants to these counties and cities for up to 50% of the capital costs of the public infrastructure related to an eligible economic development project. The purpose of these grants is to keep or enhance jobs, increase the local tax base, and expand or create new economic development in those communities. Some of the examples of what this funding has been used for includes constructing or extending utilities to industrial parks and expanding or relocating utilities to increase capacity or expand operations. Currently, the fund is running out of money, and to my understanding, there's still a number of projects in the queue that would be able to benefit if we replenish it. So this bill is to provide $2.5 million per year of the biennium to help Greater Minnesota communities grow their economies, create and retain jobs, and fill financial gaps in proposed developments. Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers via Zoom today, both of whom are recent award recipients who can speak to the value of this program. First, we have the city administrator from the city of Hermantown and Representative Zalesnikar's district up there, John Mulder, and then the city administrator from the city of Fauston, Cassie Hyde. And after they're done testifying, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, for that. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Mulder, if you can hear us okay, you can go ahead and proceed. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you very much for the opportunity to hear about a project and the impact the Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program has had in real life in Hermantown, and my testimony to support that. I'm John Mulder. I'm the city administrator and have been in Hermantown here for 15 years. Hermantown recently received a $2 million grant to aid development of public infrastructure on a 40-plus acre parcel along Highway 53 near the Duluth Airport. This site is a former EPA Superfund site, which was delisted within the last 5 years. The site has sat vacant for decades because of the environmental challenges with that land. A long time ago, it had been used as a used oil refinery, and there were and still remain concerns about contaminated soil. Since the parcel had been delisted, the city has been working with private landowners to create a business park that would have high visibility and great access due to the fact that it has frontage along Highway 53 in Hermantown. As stated, the proposed park is 40 acres, with improved infrastructure, and we would anticipate between 200,000 and 500,000 square feet of commercial space, with private investment somewhere between $50 to $100 million. We anticipate this would create between 200 and 300 jobs. The projected infrastructure costs exceed $5 million. With a state grant of $2 million, and the city would contribute another $1 million, and the balance of $2 plus million being funded by the private landowners and developers. Since that time of the announcement of that grant, we've been having ongoing discussions with companies from local businesses that want to expand or relocate to a more visible and park that is ready to go. These have been also included Fortune 500 companies that are looking to locate here in Hermantown. My testimony is really simple. That has been a game changer for Hermantown, and it's plain and simple that this business park and the potential investment development would not happen without this type of grant. The fact that it was a former EPA Superfund site and the issues of contamination, it simply wouldn't happen for private investment to put in that level of infrastructure to make this project happen. So the presence of this type of fund that exists and assists potential development is incredibly valuable to the state of Minnesota. We thank you for the grant, and we hope that you would continue to support the program. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Mulder, and appreciate your testimony today and for the great work you're doing up in Hermantown. Next up would be Ms. Heidi, City Administrator from the City of Fauston. If she could join us, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having me. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Fauston. I've been here for just about 19 years. And our story is much like Mr. Mulder's story. We are the recipients as well of this BDPI grant, and we were also recipients of a federal EDA grant for the build-out of a 40-acre industrial park in our community just off of U.S. Highway 2. And we also have the 40 acres. We're building out 12 lots, and much like the city of Hermantown, I don't believe this project would come to fruition without the additional funding from BDPI. And so, you know, these funds help keep the lot prices affordable, attracting businesses to Fauston, fostering job creation, and strengthening the local economy. Our last industrial park expansion added more than 100 jobs, surpassing the goal that was set during planning. This is our fourth industrial park expansion. You know, the funding allows us to finish out the project and concentrate on other areas of our city that need improvements to accommodate the growth that will come with this new industrial park, like housing and utility infrastructure. Since 2020, over 20 new homes and housing units have been added to Fauston that will support additional workers that are going to be needed in this as this industrial park fills. Additionally, we've been able to update our electric and natural gas utility infrastructure. And so I would just say that the impact of this grant is farther reaching beyond the project itself. It really allows small communities in greater Minnesota to get the work done that they need in their communities to be able to attract new residents, attract new businesses, and retain the size of our community. Certainly is very important, but to allow us to grow as well. And we are certainly very thankful for the funding. And thank you to Representative Johnson for bringing this forward. And I would urge you to support House File 335. Thank you for allowing me to participate via Zoom. I'm happy to be in front of you all and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Ms. Heidi. Great testimony, and appreciate what you do for the city of Fauston. No more testifiers, correct?
Correct.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. This is kind of, for lack of a better way of putting it, for greater Minnesota members, this is kind of a sexy program. You here would allocate $5 million. How did you arrive at $5 million, and where does that stand by comparison to what has been put in the fund in recent years? And is that going to be able to supply communities outside of northern Minnesota?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, so the $2.5 million per year is a slight increase on what it was before. I believe last time it was funded right around $2.2 million. And also in the governor's budget at that amount. I think the increase would fall in line with some of the inflationary things that we're seeing and just ultimately to be able to deliver more projects to greater Minnesota. Looking at some of the projects that have been handed out or awarded, those projects aren't always in the millions of dollars. Some of them are in the $200,000, $150,000 range that really impact these communities.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Johnson, I represent central Minnesota. Are we going to be able to get some dollars out of northern Minnesota?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker. You're going to have to fight for it. But it is available to greater Minnesota, which is everything outside of the seven-county metro here.
That's a great answer, Representative Johnson. Back to Representative Schultz. Any follow-up?
I was just going to congratulate Hermantown on their recent success, and the rest of us will look for our pennies.
All right. Member, any further questions? Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as somebody who represents a district that will not get anything from this, I am very familiar with the Send the Money North that our former colleague, Representative Listlegard, used to say. And I really appreciate this bill. I'm wondering if there's if there are sort of other projects in the wings that the $5 million would go to and folks are thinking about funding.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Baker, Representative Greenman. I don't have a list of the current projects in the queue. Deed probably has where that's sitting, but I don't have that information with me.
Representative Kozelski.
Thanks, Chair Baker. And thanks, Rep. Johnson, for bringing this bill. This is one that we were really proud to pass in the bonding bill. You know, we did $10 million in 2023, and it's included in the base budget, and these are funds that thinking from border to border, greater Minnesota, you know, we punch above our weight to make sure that we're supporting not just our districts, but district love to get money out to other folks too. We know that as we're facing, you know, workforce challenges and housing crisis, that these go hand in hand. And so whether it's supporting our manufacturing warehouses that are coming out to greater Minnesota, lots of folks after COVID are also looking to move out there and having challenges finding a place to live. And so these sewer hookups for creating new business industrial parks and spurring housing is exactly where I want to see us continue to move and invest. So just thank you for your good work.
Thank you. And final question, Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Not so much a question, but Representative Johnson, there used to be a fine thing we would do that whenever you had your first bill presented before a committee, you had to bring a treat. Perhaps your colleagues have not informed you of such. Much of that did go away when we were remote for 2021 and 2022, but feel free next week to share the love.
Well, and members, again, we have shared about this second offline. His predecessor, Representative Olson, was always bragging up the Johnson Bakery in Duluth, so I think we're going to have something maybe in the coming week. So no pressure, Representative Johnson, but again, I just want to thank you. Any closing comments on your bill?
Thank you, Chair Baker. Couple closing comments. In spirit of this bill to help greater Minnesota, I figured it wouldn't be appropriate for me to buy treats in the seven-county metro, so that will be have to be something I'll address when we come back next week. But I want to thank the testifiers for sharing their stories today and how these programs have impacted and allowed those communities to keep expanding. Thank you to Chair Baker and members for considering this bill. This program has helped and will hopefully continue to help communities across the state. And I am sensitive to the budget situation we're facing, but I think it's important for us to remember that we know investments like this are good for greater Minnesota, and I think we also know what's good for greater Minnesota is good for all of Minnesota. So I just want to thank everybody and urge support on this bill.
Representative Johnson, good first bill. Nice hearing. We will consider laying this bill over. We will lay this bill over for further consideration. Thank you for bringing that forward. Members, that concludes our work today. I want to give you a bit of a heads up on Tuesday. We have invited our agency deed back to rediscuss the questions that were still left from yesterday's hearing. So we'll kind of revisit that. Then we'll also probably be posting one or two or three bills on the website later today, I believe, right? Yes. So members, with that, our work is done. We are adjourned.